honeybees are value investors. So honeybees will go on our farm, and if the clover is blooming, they are going to go to the clover flowers because the clover has almost twice the sugar
this
content.
This is the butterfly effect, a
so
podcast
that, means
that
the
shows
honeybees
the big impact a
have
small
to take
action can do.
50% less energy
to
collect
special people
the honey
that make
get
a
to
difference
the hive, and they know
nature
this. They're value investors.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Orad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is Hank Zweck. Hank is a servant beekeeper, author, valued investor, and a former psychologist who is now retired. For 30 years, Hank worked as a clinical psychologist in Ontario, Canada, and for 40 years as a value investor in real estate, bonds, stocks, and early stage startups. Now he's focusing on bees. In 2017, Hank and his wife Marie started converting their 50 acres farm back to nature as a honeybee sanctuary. Hank, together with Marie, wrote a book with their work, and I'm excited to have Hank here today. Welcome, Hank, to The Butterfly Effect.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
So first I want to understand, you are a psychologist, been working as a clinical psychologist for 30 years and then helping many people throughout your career. And then for 40 years, I'm assuming in parallel, also investing. And now beekeeping. What made you do that shift?
That's a great question. It's very much by accident initially. I like to grow garlic. And so on our 50 acre farm, garlic, if you know, you have to rotate you can only grow it once every 3 years in the same spot. So we have 50 acres, but we have a house. And so I was always looking for places to plant my garlic. Now, I plant about as much garlic as a kitchen table would take up. And because the soil here is so incredible, I can do 100 bulbs of garlic on just that small space. But because the farm was being farmed conventionally, we have some of the best land in the country here, there was always exposure to sprays, herbicides, Roundup primarily. So I couldn't find, it got to the point where after a couple of years I couldn't find any more garlic land. So I started by roping off an area and told my buddy not to plant, you know, any crops and don't spray Roundup. But turned out, we started talking saying, you know, this is kind of dumb. Why don't we just stop all this and let's just make it go back to nature? Over 120 or 30 years, the farm had been farmed intensively because we have, again, some of the greatest land. But what was so fascinating is when we stopped, the first year we did nothing. We just let the land rest. And that first year without any planting, we had over 90 different species of wildflowers. And we hadn't planted anything. So for 100 and some years, the land was just getting beat up with sprays and pests. And it was orchards before that, cherries, peaches, and plums, and apples, and you know the kind of spray that goes on there over the years. So all of a sudden, nature came back. And then, of course, we planted tall grass prairie, and we got more involved. So we have two ponds. Some years ago, we had taken out some land and planted trees, probably about 25 years ago, just to have some of that buffer. So it just sort of was an evolving accidental, I call it a bumbling and stumbling kind of thing. You know, you just kind of get pushed into an area and you just take it. It's what it is. And I was initially afraid of bees as a child. We had bees on the farm. My dad was a beekeeper. By the way, beekeeper's kind of silly because you can't really keep bees. Like they fly
right.
Whatever they want. Right? They do whatever they want.
So you don't keep them, you protect them.
Well, yeah. And my challenge, and we can talk about that, is being a servant beekeeper, as I call it, where you don't want to do too much because you actually can harm them by doing too much. And a lot of the practices we use in livestock beekeeping is great for production, but we've kind of gotten to a point where we've not let bees, you know, adjust and accommodate and provide them with habitat. You know, the biggest problem we have is bees have no place to live.
Right. Your farm was an actual functioning working farm, and I'm assuming you had people working on it, and now it's just, you're not doing anything with it, just let it be heaven for bees?
Well, it was totally planned out. So we have a section of the farm where we planted traditional tall grass prairie that would have been here 200-300 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then we have another section of the farm where we planted wildflowers. And then another section where we actually have planted different clovers to help recover the land and also to give wildlife, sort of, I call it the gas station for insects and natural pollinators. So we planted a lot of clovers because clovers, as you know, brings in a lot of nutrients down into the soil, takes out toxins in the air. Mm-hmm. The natural pollinators and the honeybees can get food. So we kind of designed it for natural pollinators and nature.
And did you study any of that? I mean, you said your father was doing it, but did you study it? Did you go to courses
I crossed over as a psychologist when I was in the clinics, and we had four clinics that we started. We spent a lot of our work. I was really fascinated by the lack of recovery of some people from concussions. So mm-hmm. when I sort of get into an area, I kind of dive in, like call world experts, bother them till they'll talk to me, and find out, you know, what's missing, where, just drill down. And so when I moved over to bees, it became the same process. So I looked at everything that was being done.
You drilled down the bees?
I guess I'm obsessed. Once I get into an area, if I open that door, I've got to get all the way in and look at and open myself up to listen to every type of bee keeping or bee motivation or environmental stuff. To be quite honest, we probably know as a world 5% of what we need to know about bees. We don't know very much. We think we know. This is the problem. We think we know a lot about honeybees and how to help them, but often we hurt them when we're trying to help them. It's all well-intentioned. Mm-hmm. But we really don't stop and just listen and watch what they are doing. And they will tell us what they need in their own way.
And what have you learned with your drilling?
The first one was habitat's extremely important. So it sounds common sense, but we often ignore that. You have to give wildlife, natural pollinators, bumblebees, and honeybees, a place to live that is healthy for them as far as food, you know, water, clean water. Lack of stress. Bees are really impacted by stress. Now think about this for a minute. Say you're sitting at the kitchen table having some lunch, and all of a sudden the roof of your house is taken off. A big hand comes down, moves your furniture around, picks up your refrigerator, looks at what's inside, puts it back down, and then puts the roof back on. And every 2 weeks this happens, from probably May until September, October. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's once a month, but usually it's every 2 weeks recommended. How stressed are we going to be? What we find is simple practices like that that are recommended for beekeepers puts bees under stress, because all of a sudden they have to deal with the whole issue of uncertainty. Plus, it's kind of, a beehive is kind of like, do you remember when you make, anyone in your family, I've made them, chocolate chip cookies, what that does to the smell of your house or bread.
Yeah.
The honey beehive has a certain fragrance about it, which is in balance. As soon as we open up the lid and take the roof off to look inside, we remove all of those incredibly helpful smells. We call them smells. They're actually pheromones that help the bees communicate, survive, know there's no stress. Mm-hmm. Just by that one action alone, we add stress to their life. So I've learned that you have to try to look at those things and help bees be less stressful. So we only go in once or twice a year if we have to, sometimes not at all. Hmm. To look into a hive to make sure we can't help and not hurt them. And so I think I've learned that. I've also learned that the hardest thing for me is not to do anything when I think I can help them, when that helping may long-term hurt them. That's the hardest thing for me. Hmm. That because we've had a cold spring, there are probably some hives that could benefit by me feeding them. Now, traditionally, beekeepers will feed them sugar water. I actually have frames of honey that we save, but we don't use them to save them now. We give that in case we're doing a split, it's called, which is a natural way to swarm bees. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard for me not to go around and lift the back of hives, and when there's a light hive, go put a frame in, because I know that will guarantee their survival. But am I helping a strain of bees survive that in the end will harm the whole species?
Right. So you wrote a book with... I guess life lessons.
What can you? Grandkids.
Yes, for your grandkids, which is very inspiring. So, I would love for you to talk a little bit more about the book. Share with us what's in it.
So, as you said at the intro, I've been a vester for 40 years, and one of the things we have, which I don't want my grandkids to experience, is financial illiteracy, and not understanding the link between a balanced life with the environment and nature. And so what I've experienced in my 40 years, for example, we have a lot of solar systems we've installed for different reasons, but I believe in certain aspects of solar power, but it has to be a good business model as well as an environmental model.
Mm-hmm.
And so when honeybees go out and they get pollen, we all know they pollinate, they improve the pollination of plants that helps us eat food and so on.
Right.
But the bees do it accidentally. They don't purposely wake up in the morning and say, okay, I'm going to go to the apple tree and I'm going to pollinate more apples. It just bumbles and stumbles while it's trying to get food or pollen or nectar. And that in the end becomes good for the trees, which in the end becomes better for the next generation of bees. So honeybees will only do things that are good for the community, but the things that are good for the community happen to be incredibly valuable to the environment. That was one of the biggest, along with the second one I'm going to talk about, is environment in balance with reality, so that bees are all about survival. Bees do what they have to do to survive. And many people think investing is about getting a great return on your investment, but the first thing you do when you invest is make sure you get your money back. And that's survival.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you start thinking about survival, you start thinking about a different sort of format, and the purpose of it becomes a very different thing.
Maybe we can go a little bit about that. So I'm just curious, what's the innovative approaches to financing and I guess supporting, whether it's with the bees or with companies?
Okay, so let's look at two. One is about bees. Honeybees are value investors. So honeybees will go on our farm, and if the clover is blooming at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they are going to go to the clover flowers because the clover has almost twice the sugar content of other flowers. So that means that the honeybees have to take 50% less energy to collect the honey, the nectar that they turn into honey when they get back to the hive. And they know this. They're value mm-hmm. investors. And so we as humans often, and we talk about it in the book, we have a poor education on how to assess value in something. So whether it's real estate, whether it's a stock or bond, for example, real estate recently, people often would say, well, the house is worth $1 million because that's what the price is.
Mm-hmm.
But the price of something has nothing to do with the value. And so we learn from the honeybees, it's always about looking at the true value and being aware of that, of how you see what you should pay or what is it worth having this product,
right,
service. And that really is about needing to be educated in that area. Bees are experts at flowers. I mean, they know when they fly by the shade of the blossom, time of year, so many other things, that is a good or not good flower to forage on today at 10 o'clock versus today at 2 o'clock. They're experts. And I think if you're going to be an investor in something or an area, you need to get very good at spending time reading about that area. Or the other one that's really huge in investing is little bits become big bits. Honeybees in their lifetime collect very little nectar on their own, but when combined, it's hundreds of pounds of honey for the hive. So we often ignore that. If children started at, my grandchildren started now when they're 1 or 2 years old, putting $5 a week, in an investment account, they would have millions when they're 60. Someone in their 20s might have to put $25 or $50 a week. So we ignore that magic of little bits become big bits that the bees tell us about every day. You know, a little bit of this makes a huge difference. And I think that's another important one when you look at companies. Are companies practicing that?
Right.
You know, and are they in tune with the environment?
I like that. Well, it's a little bit all together. You can look at it as a community contributing together, and you can look at it as you need to give it time. It's not right away, right? So I think it's both ways. So we talked a little bit on companies looking for value and investors looking for return on investment. So I'm just curious, in what ways can corporations and businesses can integrate principles of sustainability and responsible stewardship into their financial decision making, and how might this benefit both kind of like their bottom line and then obviously the health of the planet?
Well, let's talk about one of the companies we talk about in the book, Because we tell B stories each chapter, and then we talk about a smart money example. And then the third section of each chapter is an investment example. And so if I look at, say, real estate, where we have some of our investments, and we have properties where we have solar made sense as a company for us because it was a good thing, but it also was a good business decision. Because mm-hmm. the return on solar in Canada is anywhere from 7 to 9%, assuming the price of energy does not go up for the next 30 years. So if everything stays the same, the return on our solar investments are about 7 to 9%. But because of what's already happened since we installed them, it's more like 10, 11, 12%. So if you look at companies that are doing, or in my business, which is say rental units or apartment units, if they are starting to convert units to solar and having more energy that's helpful, and also environmental practices like recycling, it helps their bottom line, but it also helps the environment and the community. And so when you look at, in my case, I take a lot of time studying companies, public companies that are involved in rental units. When they start to have strong environmental policies based on sound business, they become more attractive as an investment. And long term, for example, you know, when interest rates go up, people say, well, an 8% return isn't that great. It's kind of boring. You know, mm-hmm. it's solar. It's not exciting. But the long term of that is incredibly beneficial. And plus, it's a little bit. A little bit becomes a big bit. And companies can do that by practicing that kind of due diligence and transparency and really talking about why they're doing it. Now, the problem I have with some companies that call themselves environmental companies, for example, one large company in the United States that has landfills all over the world and does not believe in recycling, but are still considered a recycling company, which I find fascinating. So as the public needs to be sure that when they look at this whole issue of environmental, you know, practices, that they really drill down in and look at what happens. Because, for example, bees are incredible recyclers. Like they recycle unbelievably if they can.
So they recycle or they reuse?
No, what they do is when they swarm, or when they're about to swarm, mm-hmm. they send out scouts. Mm-hmm. And the scouts go and they look for a place to live. And one of their coveted places to live would be a former beehive area, like for could be a log that's hollowed out or another beehive that has some wax remaining, mm-hmm. because it takes something like 6 pounds of honey to make 1 pound of wax. So if they can recycle wax that has already been used by someone else, their chances of survival go up significantly. So they are just the consummate recyclers. And the same thing with propolis. They will use propolis in the fall to cover up any cracks in their home to prevent cold air and things coming in. But in the spring, they open that up again for ventilation, and they take the propolis and recycle it by putting it on the base of their hive inside or their landing, because it's one of the best antiseptic bacterial killing natural products that you can find. And they recycle it, and then in the fall they do it all over again. It's a valued commodity for them. So it's to make propolis from scratch, the bees have to go out and access different tree saps and plant saps and mix it with their enzymes, and then they create the propolis, which takes a lot more energy than getting it from an existing area.
That's fascinating. So you talk a little bit about the recycling, but also innovation. So what are some innovating approaches to financing and supporting bee conservation efforts, and how can we as individuals and organizations, right, get involved in these initiatives?
I think that it starts with something we discussed earlier, which is responsibility. So we all have a part in this, to play in this. And it's the question is, you know, what are we willing to do? Because we all have a little something we can do. And there's something we can do to make it better today. We talk a lot about sustainability in a honeybee hive. And I know when I went to visit in Europe and Italy, every backyard had almost an entire self-sustaining food grocery store. There were trees, there were chickens, there were gardens. If you really had to, you could probably survive on what you grew in your backyard. Mm-hmm. And that was, at one level, that's a sustainability model, but it's also a business model that has an opportunity for a business to step in and help people do that, for example. So, and I've tried, I do invest in some startups. I've tried to get a startup to do this and they won't, which is a service business where you go in and help people set up their backyard sustainability system. And you have a section for pollinators that you just, you know, you grow clover and you just leave it. You have another section, and you don't have to have a large plot of land for this. And you may want to, in my case, for example, if I took three kitchen table sized plots of land, I could grow enough garlic for probably three other families.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could trade that for what they grow, you know. So there's
right.
there's different things we can get involved with, which are not just sustainable, good for the planet, but good for the bottom line for us. And there are companies that could step in and do that. One of the things we also see in the area of the what I call transparency is the footprint. So, for example, my house might be 2,500 square feet. Can I take 2,500 square feet somewhere else and support trees? Or plant the number of trees that I had to replace as a human to live in this house.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, yes, I can. It's not easy to do right now, but that's another one of the goals we have in some of the land we've purchased to, you know, restore back to nature, where we're going to add clovers and we're going to add trees and we're going to find a way to be so transparent that it's actually registered on the title of the property. And we have arborists going in with drones and you know, identifying what's on that property. And then we're going to do that every year and send that to people so they can see that this, you know, this land exists, this is what we're doing, and this is how nature's responding. And I mentioned clover. I mean, a person who has a little plot of land can plant some flowers, wildflowers, that is an incredible support for natural pollinators, bumblebees and other, mm-hmm. other types of insects, but also for conventional honeybees. So there's those types of initiatives that we can also do.
Yeah. So I liked it to start talking about the kind of like balancing and what we can do. And before we can, we'll dive into that. I just want to ask, how can we balance the economic benefits of commercial beekeeping with the need to protect and support wild bees populations? And I mean, they have a huge importance in ecological roles, right? They have a huge ecological role.
Well, the truth, though, is if you, like when we did our farm, what we noticed is we had a lot of bumblebees suddenly appear. Bumblebees are 2.5 times more efficient in pollinating crops than honeybees. And so wild pollinators as well are significantly important. So when you create a habitat for conventional honeybees or what we call conventional beekeeping, if you create the proper habitat, you create this incredible ecosystem for all kinds of beneficial insects that can help us.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had 1 acre for every 100 acres that we intensively farmed put aside for this type of thing that we're doing here, you would probably have less of a need to import as many bees as you do, which is very stressful on bees.
Yeah,
I think it's comparable to the different ways we raise livestock today. And what are we willing as a public to accept as being the right way or the healthy way to create products that we're going to consume, whether it be plants or animals. I mean, for example, one thing I know because I was in the fruit industry, it makes little sense to wash an apple. Most pesticides are systemic, which means when they're sprayed, they go into the leaves, into the plant, and into the fruit. It's in the meat of the fruit. So you can wash a plant forever, a piece of fruit forever.
Right.
In most cases, you're not going to eliminate all of the things that plant's been exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think until we get that kind of transparency, for example, with honey or bee products, we're not going to get real change in that industry. We have to be transparent and tell people just what we're doing. The conventional beekeeping, and I'm not saying it's good or bad, I'm just saying what happens is very much about using pesticides and fungicides and all kinds of things to treat the bees for different problems.
Mm-hmm.
And the push in Europe and the success they've had is with more natural methods, meaning letting nature take over, and it's a lot more work, but the bees actually end up becoming able to adapt to what's happened to them and take care of themselves, which they always have. So that's kind of the challenge. Conventional, and the other thing I've noticed about beekeeping, which I find hard, is that people aren't as open about other opinions. I mean, it's not just beekeeping.
It's everywhere, yes.
Too. But I was at the conference a week ago, and someone had a few hives, and they were talking, and we were talking, and the gentleman said, "Well, you have to do this." And I said, "Well, I could do that."
Yeah.
But you don't have to do anything, and I don't have to do anything. I could. So there's very much this, if you don't do it the way I do it, you're somehow harming, you know, the industry or whatever, which is not true. So we're not open enough to accepting what happened in Europe. And actually, there's a commercial bee operation in Texas that is totally treatment-free, that has thousands of hives, a commercial beekeeper. Mm-hmm. Doesn't use any pesticides, any herb, any miticides, and we're talking thousands of hives.
Oh, wow.
And it's, I think it's Bee Weaver is the name, and they split with his brother. His brother continues to hive the practice the way his father had hives, and he is doing it completely treatment-free. And he's just as, I mean, he has, his bees have adapted. He has a new strain of bees, and they're able to survive in his microclimate. Now, the problem is, bees are very micro-orientated. So his bees, if I brought up here to Canada, they're not going to immediately thrive because it's a different environment. He's
right.
In Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And even the neighborhood, even on our 50-acre farm, we have different sensors. There can be different temperatures and humidities in different parts of our 50-acre farm, and that can vary by up to 10 degrees Celsius on any day.
That's fascinating. So just so I understand, even though you're in the field of pollinating, the beekeeping industry is not pollinating each other, right?
You mean as far as sharing ideas and so on? It's very
and accepting,
close.
Yeah.
It's very much, and it's also motivated. I know this sounds a bit conspiracy-like, but there's a huge industry when it comes to treating bees for diseases. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes legislated in some countries where you have to do this. You have to treat your bees. Now they're talking about vaccinating your bees.
Wow.
Which I mean, when I watch my honeybees, we have a small group and we tested some thymol, which comes from the thyme herb, and formic acid, which actually occurs naturally in honey, but it's in higher concentrations on just a few hives to see if there's any difference. There doesn't appear to be any difference in survivability, and it also introduces something to the bees that I don't think is healthy. Because remember, I think there's something like 80 different mites in a hive that are beneficial to a hive, and when you use a miticide to kill the varroa destructor mite, you kill all the other mites that are good for the bees, and you weaken the queen. And I think this is probably the last year where we even do that research. We're going to strictly focus on what was done in Europe and Texas and all over and create the bees that will survive in these climate conditions and also keep improving the habitat.
Right. Okay, so you talked a little bit about vaccinations, and we know bees are dying all over. And I'm just curious what financial incentives and policies mechanism could we implement to encourage individuals and business to take more action to protect bees and other pollinators?
Well, like most things, I think it's important to have true, transparent research. And our type of research that we do here is very much like there's no funding source. It's just what we can afford to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal is to figure out how we can help them. And I think if we have less incentive in the sense of, you know, I'm not doing this research because I want to promote a certain pesticide or any kind of
right.
help. Mm-hmm. And it's also thinking long term. So you have to remember that in the summer, a honeybee lives for about 6 weeks. During that 6 week period, new things it learns becomes through neuroplasticity part of their brain. Like the honeybee has an incredible ability to transfer experience to neurological hardwiring. Their brain's about the size of a sesame seed. But in it, there's over a million connections. And it changes based on their experience. And then the most fascinating thing of all, when they go to swarm, they have to create a new queen. And the honeybees, the worker bees who have had all these experiences, create the royal jelly by using enzymes from their own body, which are now proven to transfer to the new queen the changes in the neurology of the working bee.
Wow.
So the new queen, when she lays eggs, has the benefit of what that previous generation of workers did. Now, there's another fascinating thing. I hope you don't mind me sharing this.
No, please.
So when a queen no longer makes it, so let's say you have a hive and all of a sudden the queen dies or flies and doesn't come back. A bird ate it.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the hive is queenless, and if there are no eggs to create a new queen, what often happens is a worker bee will start laying eggs. But because the worker bee is not a queen, she can only lay drones. But if we think for a moment A worker bee that lays drones is creating a genetic blueprint of herself that will then create a drone that can go then and pass off that to other queens mm-hmm. through the drones.
Mm-hmm.
So nature, even though in traditional beekeeping, people would say, well, when you're queenless, you have to introduce a new queen, or you split up the frames and move them around because it's horrible to have a worker bee lay eggs. My observations have been that when a worker bee starts laying eggs, it's a way that, I don't want to say spirit because I don't want to lose people, but there's a connection between the need for that worker bee to transfer its genetics to the next generation. Now, traditional beekeepers have gotten mad at me when I ask that question. I say, well, how do you explain worker bees laying eggs in drones? And they don't want to discuss it because it doesn't fit in the usual training of conventional beekeepers. But I think that's another valuable lesson from bees, how adaptable they are and how clever. I mean, can you imagine that the food that the eggs are fed transfers the genetics of the worker bees to the next generation?
Yeah, that's incredible.
And that would explain how they do it, how in 6 weeks, the bees have now a new neurological map that they transfer to the next generation of bees. And that's why when you encourage bees to swarm, which, by the way, isn't done in conventional beekeeping,
mm-hmm.
when you encourage bees to do this, you actually encourage the transfer of these new beneficial behaviors or, strains that will then help survive problems that you don't have to treat for.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. So I'm just curious if you have any other fun facts that you can share.
Bees are always under attack. So in our community here, in our climate, wasps will continually try to attack a hive.
Mm-hmm.
And so a wasp will go to the front of a hive and test the guards, because every beehive has a guard system, a group of bees that are designed to protect the hive at the entrance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wasp will sort of get closer and closer and closer, and eventually sometimes the guards will come out. Sometimes the wasp will actually get close to the entrance and then get pushed away by the bees. But on occasion, the wasps will sort of get as close as they can to a bee that's fanning the hive in the summer. And some of the pheromones from that bee will get on the wasp, and the bee will then try to sneak in smelling, if you could use the word smell, smelling like a bee that should live there.
Mm-hmm.
So when the wasp scout gets in, its only purpose is to figure out how strong are the defenses and how close can I get to the food. And the food represents either the honey, but often it's the babies because they want to steal the protein of those little larvae.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it's discovered, the bees drag out the wasp, but they don't kill it. And I always wondered about that. I mean, if the wasp will go and attack a queen, it will be dispatched by the hive very quickly. But if it goes in to try to scout, what the bees do skillfully is they drag it out and they make it go away. And the reason we believe they do that is to send the message to the scout when it goes back to its nest that that's not a hive you should mess with. Because if they killed that wasp,
yeah,
that message would not get transferred and more scouts would come to see and it would take more work. So they're actually planning ahead by sending the message. And if you transfer that to humans, it's very important when you look at, people who study martial arts and black belt folks,
mm-hmm.
they say the purpose of having that is not to ever use it,
yes,
but to know you can respect it and use it very rarely. And that's what I've learned from the honeybees. And so in any negotiation, in any type of situation, it's helpful for you to have the ability to do what you have to do, but to never use it under control. But make sure the other side knows you have it.
Yeah.
Whether it's a bully on the playground,
yeah,
or a company trying to take you over, or someone who's disrespecting you in a business relationship.
Yeah.
It's often important that you don't need to do that. And in real life, in human life, instead of harming someone, you hire a really good lawyer to fix it for you.
Yeah.
But you don't have to do that until you're at that point where the message has been sent but not received. So that's a really it's almost like many of these philosophies are universal, that they go from bees to the environment to business
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
us. And the one we haven't discussed is the spiritual connection bees provide, which, takes us down a road of more qualitative discussions, but I think really valuable when it comes to understanding nature.
So So you talk more about the spiritual as individuals or spiritual as a community and their values?
I think that this, I mean, these are just, I don't really know very much. I'm just basing it on my experience in the past 5 years. But one of the things I've noticed is when I'm really attuned to the bees, so when I'm listening and watching and letting my brain just totally focus on what I see in front of me,
mm-hmm.
and smelling and hearing and listening, there's a connection we make. The other day I was in front of a hive and they were out flying, and I don't know where they were getting this, but it was like 4 degrees Celsius and they're bringing in pollen and nectar. And I'm just sort of, I like to get pretty close. So I'm standing there and a couple of bees come over and they just sit on my arm. And I just look at these guys and they look at me and they're just sort of moving around and I'm thinking, this is pretty cool. And I felt, I kind of understand, I know this sounds really bizarre, but I just felt
connected, and
I could hear them better. And they were so happy to go out. They were very happy. There's different sounds that the hive as a community emits when they're happy, when they're sad, when they're angry, when they're joyous. I mean, when a queen, when they raise a queen and that queen hatches, goes out, comes back, and is ready to take on, you know, laying of eggs, they are so excited and so happy. And then you see a hive that has a loss of a queen, and some of them get busy. But some of them just give up. Yeah. They just say, that's it. There's nothing. We don't. And you open the hive to make sure they're okay, and they don't even move hardly. They just sort of they'll walk around. They won't try to sting you.
Yeah.
And whereas other hives who have a lot of desire and purpose, they will get very aggressive because they know that they're vulnerable without a queen, and they're going to protect their home until they can have a queen. So it's, you know, when you get sensitive to that, and you begin to feel that, there's a connection then to nature. Because the bees are kind of like that canary in the coal mine when it comes to how well the habitat and how well everything else is going.
Yeah. So what can individuals do to protect the environment and support health of bees everywhere?
I think that's a great question. I think you start by getting connected yourself. So if you can find a place where you can go and just sit and do what I call non-purposeful immersion in nature. So you're not fishing. I like to fly fish. You're not doing that. You're not doing any collecting mushrooms or running in a forest. You're just sitting and doing nothing in the sense of other than listening to nature.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you start to develop a pattern of connection, that would be the first step for me. 10 to 15 minutes a day if you can, if you sit even near a park, someplace where you can get connected to trees, flowers, nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the second step is if you can immerse yourself, and many beekeepers will do this, if you have a beekeeper in your community, see if they'll let you get suited up and just sort of be around and help maybe move a few things. Just spend a day with a beekeeper. Because when you're around bees, once you get over the fear, and many of us are instinctively afraid of bees, that's why I'm always suited up. You see beekeepers who feel like, you know, I'm going to go in shorts and t-shirts, and if you make a mistake and accidentally squeeze a bee, that bee will sting you and it will pass.
Yeah.
And immediately the bees know where you were stung, and many will come and do the same thing.
Hmm.
And they will lose their life doing that. So to protect the bees more than myself, I think it's helpful to be fully. And if a person was fully dressed for protection and went out to a hive and just sort of, you know, near the entrance could hear them and see them and get a little bit involved, then I think it would open up the world of responsibility where we realize we're all a part of this world and we're all sort of connected. You know, I know the name of your podcast is about the butterfly effect and how we're all connected, how everything matters. So if a person plants a, you know, a 4-foot by 4-foot little patch of wildflowers, that will have an impact on more than just that. And as soon as we start to accept and realize that we do have a role to play, and it's not one or the other, it's not profit and business or the environment, it's both. We can have great businesses and great lifestyles and still respect what we have. I think one of the things that at this conference, the most important thing that came in, there was an Aboriginal leader that started off with a brief explanation. And then he said, I want you all to remember that, forget all the carbon offset calculations and all this business stuff. He says, just remember your job is to help heal Mother Earth.
Amen.
And the entire 4 days, you know, there was all these government folks talking, United Nations, Save the Planet stuff. I could not stop thinking about Save the Planet Earth. And does this thing in front of me right now going to help us all Monday morning? And usually the answer is no. So if we don't take responsibility as people, I don't think anybody else is going to do it. So even that little 4x4 piece of land in your backyard, or maybe you, and here we have a problem because our communities, municipal governments, like to cut all the ditches. The bees have nothing to eat unless you grow it yourself, because the government cuts or sprays Roundup on all the roadside habitat that could exist for honeybees and wildlife. Mm-hmm. So maybe advocating to your local municipal government to stop doing that. They don't need, other than safety reasons near intersections where they may have to keep it down, most of the time they don't have to cut the grass in a ditch.
Yeah.
And if you can get them to stop doing that, all of a sudden you have more habitat for your entire ecosystem, which will benefit us health-wise in the long run. So I think little steps are important, but first get attuned to it. Make it become part of who you are.
Yes, I totally agree. Okay, so from bees, which I know they are a very important part for the trees as well, I'm just curious, what is your favorite tree?
I love the smell of white pine, but I absolutely love oak trees. We have those too. Anything that's growing.
I love that. Thank you so much, Hank, for sharing your life lessons and love to bees. I appreciate
that. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you, everyone, for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.